So I'll be talking about using... Help. Can you hear me now? Is that okay? Okay. So I'll be talking about neutrino astronomy. Electromagnetic waves like visible light, radio waves, even X-rays and gamma rays can really only tell us about the surface of an astronomical object like the sun or a star, because electromagnetic waves can penetrate a few microns to maybe a few meters in stellar matter. So we want information about the nuclear processes occurring at the core of the sun or an exploding star. You need some radiation that can penetrate a distance greater than the radius of that sun or star. And neutrinos fit the bill, because neutrinos are so penetrating that they can penetrate through 400 light years of lead. And there is no 400 light year thick wall of lead anywhere in the universe that we know of. And so that means that the Earth and the sun and the universe is practically transparent to neutrinos. So 400 light years is like the distance from the Earth to the Pleiades star cluster. So in today's presentation, I'll talk about using neutrinos to observe one particular type of astronomical object, and that is a core collapse supernova. So what on earth is a neutrino? I'll remind you that there are four fundamental types of forces in the universe. The electromagnetic force is the force that binds electrons to the atomic nucleus and makes atoms possible. Also is what makes electronics possible. So this is ubiquitous and we're all familiar with it. Gravity is also very familiar. That's what holds us to the surface of the Earth and makes the moon go around the Earth. These two other forces are not so familiar. The strong nuclear force holds the protons and neutrons together inside the atomic nucleus. This weak nuclear force is responsible for radioactive decay of nuclei. And so when you compare the strength of these four forces, the strong force, if you say that has a relative strength of one, then this is about 1% of that. The weak force is about 10 to the minus 13 of that. So it's much, very, very much weaker than the electromagnetic force. And gravity is even much weaker than that. So on the scale of subatomic particles, gravity really plays no important role. Remind you that the atom consists of electrons, which are negatively charged, orbiting around the positively charged atomic nucleus. Electrons actually take up most of the space inside an atom, so that if you were to enlarge an electron to the size of a football stadium, the atomic nucleus would be like a cherry at the center of that football stadium. The electrons do not feel the strong nuclear force. They only feel the electromagnetic and the weak force and gravity. As we heard in the previous talk, electrons have more massive cousins called the mu and the tau, which are also negatively charged. So we have the electron, the mu, and the tau, which are negatively charged particles. And these also have their antimatter equivalents. So in addition to that negatively charged electron, you have an antimatter electron, which is positively charged. That's what's used in positron emission tomography for PET scans in nuclear medicine. Similarly, the muon has a positively charged cousin, and the tau has a positively charged cousin. So that's those are leptons. So imagine if you could make an electron lose its negative charge somehow. That's basically what a neutrino is. So an electron neutrino, Greek symbol nu with a subscript e, is an electron that's lost its negative charge. Since it has no charge anymore, it doesn't feel the electromagnetic force, it only feels the weak force. And so the electron and its heavier cousins, the mu and the tau, each have a corresponding uncharged neutrinos, and we call these different flavors of neutrinos. So the nu e is the neutrino corresponding to the electron, and then nu mu is the neutrino corresponding to the muon, and nu tau is the neutrino corresponding to the tau. And so similarly, each one of these has a corresponding antiparticle, which you could think of the anti-nu e is an anti-electron that's lost its positive charge, and so on. So how weakly do neutrinos interact with matter? So if you just hold your thumb up for a moment, in 1 second, about 10 to the power 11, 100 billion neutrinos from the sun pass through the end of your thumb each second. But with all these neutrinos passing through your body each second, on the average, about one of them will make a hit on one atom in your body during your whole lifetime. And the vast majority of them just go streaming straight through your body, straight through the rest of the earth, just through the universe with no interactions whatsoever. And so that means that if you want to detect even a minuscule fraction of all these neutrinos that are streaming through your body and through the earth, you need to build a detector of large mass so you can catch as many of them as possible. Have to bury these detectors deep underground to shield these detectors from the rain of cosmic radiation that is striking the surface of the earth. And so you can think of these neutrino detectors as neutrino telescopes that we use to view the universe using neutrinos. Here's an example of one. This is the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory. It is an acrylic sphere which contain 1,000 tons of heavy water. You can see the size of this sphere with these people standing right here. Viewed by 9,500 of these 8-inch photomultiplier tubes. You can think of these electronic eyes that detect the faint flashes of light that are generated when neutrinos hit the matter inside the sphere. And so this was the detector that solved the problem of the missing solar neutrinos by showing that neutrinos have non-zero mass and can oscillate from one flavor into another. That won the Nobel Prize in 2015 for Professor Art MacDonald. Now this detector has been filled with another liquid scintillator that makes even bigger flashes of light, and it's embarking on another program of studying neutrinos. Here's an even bigger detector. This is a Super Kamiokande neutrino detector in Japan. This is a 40-meter diameter by 40-meter high tank of ultra-pure water buried in a mountain near the west coast of Japan. This is what it looks like if you were to go inside this tank. You could just see the walls are just paved with these, in this case, 18-inch glass eyes, photomultiplier tubes, which detect the faint flashes of light made by neutrinos hitting stuff in this water. Here's a picture of the technicians rowing around on the surface of this water in a rubber dinghy to service these photomultiplier tubes. So this thing is already huge. They are planning to build something 10 times bigger. It'll be called a Hyper Kamiokande neutrino detector. This is the granddaddy of all neutrino detectors. This is the ice cube detector at the South Pole, where scientists have instrumented 1 cubic kilometer of Antarctic ice to be the neutrino detector. So during the Antarctic summer, they go there and they use jets of very hot water to drill these boreholes about 18 inches in diameter and about 1.5 miles deep into the Antarctic ice. And then while the water is still liquid, they lower in these strings of photomultiplier tubes and it freezes in place. When neutrinos make hits in the ice, it makes this cone of light that these photosensors can detect. So here is a picture of a core collapse supernova. It marks the end of the life of a massive star. You can see here, it's probably too bright to see, you can see the spiral galaxy here, Messier 101. And here is the supernova. So if you had taken a picture a few days before, this star here would not be here. And for a few days, this one star shines as brightly as the other 100 billion stars in that galaxy added together. So here is a picture of the remnant of a supernova. This is the Crab Nebula. It's the remains that you can see today in a telescope. It's the remains of a supernova that exploded in 1054 AD. And after it exploded, it was so bright that it could be seen in broad daylight by the naked eye for several weeks. So already it's a spectacular object in an optical telescope or in optical wavelengths, but actually, it's 10,000 times brighter than that if you had eyes that could see in neutrinos. neutrinos actually carry away 99% of the energy from a core collapse supernova, and the optical radiation only carries away 0.01%. So here's what happens in a core collapse supernova. During a star's lifetime, it generates heavier and heavier elements, and those heavier elements are generated at the core of the star. And so during its lifetime, it'll make elements like hydrogen will fuse into helium, helium will fuse into carbon, carbon and helium will fuse into oxygen and so on, until it builds up an iron core at the center of that star. So this is what a star looks like right before it collapses. You've got an iron core surrounded by these shells of lighter and lighter elements. Now, iron is the most tightly bound nucleus that there is. It's the most stable configuration of protons and neutrons, and that means that if it's the most stable, the lowest energy state, no matter what you do to iron, whether you try to make it undergo nuclear fusion or nuclear fission, there's no more nuclear energy to be had. And so that's the end of the road as far as nuclear energy production is concerned. And so when you reach iron, nuclear energy production stops. There's no more heat and pressure coming from the center. That star shrinks because it doesn't have that pressure coming from the inside. And that shrinking stops when you get to this state of degenerate electron gas. That is, you've got these iron nuclei surrounded by this sea of electrons, which is compressed as close together as quantum mechanics will allow. So this stuff is already, you know, fantastically dense. One teaspoon of this degenerate electron gas matter would weigh 500 tons. And we don't have any of this in any laboratory in the world, obviously. Astronomers see stars which are composed of this. If you look at the star Sirius, which is the brightest star in the sky, it has a faint little companion star, Sirius B, and it is a white dwarf which is composed of this sort of material. And so by looking at the spectrum of Sirius B, we know it's as hot and as massive as the sun, but it's only about the size of the Earth. So as dense as this stuff is, if you can imagine, if you could somehow get rid of these electrons, those electrons could be absorbed by the nuclei, then this stuff could become even more dense, right? I mean, it's like a football stadium collapsing down into the size of a cherry. And it takes energy to do that. There's an energy penalty for an electron to be absorbed by the nucleus. That energy penalty just scales as the mass of that star. You have twice the mass, you need twice the energy penalty. But you also gain energy because when you shrink it down, you lower the gravitational potential energy, and that goes parabolically. So it's like this red curve here. And at some point, which turns out to be about 1.4 solar masses, the energy penalty is exceeded by the energy that you gain. And so at that point, it becomes energetically possible to have a gravitational collapse. So when that happens, all those electrons get absorbed by the protons in the nucleus. So all the electrons disappear, and the protons get turned into neutrons to conserve charge. And so this stuff becomes a big ball of neutrons. So that's a neutron star, and all those electrons get turned into neutrinos. They've lost their negative charge and get turned into neutrinos. And so that former Earth-sized iron core shrinks down to something like 20 kilometers in diameter and becomes a dense sphere of mostly neutrons of nuclear density. And so that's even denser, where one teaspoon will weigh 5 billion tons. So here's a cartoon. This iron core shrinks down to almost nothing. It leaves a void. There's no support for the overlying material. That overlying material accelerates towards this neutron star. It reaches about 25% the speed of light when it hits the surface of that neutron star and compresses that neutron star to something like 2 to 4 times nuclear matter density. That's called the accretion phase of the supernova. The shockwave rebounds back outwards. It stalls momentarily because it's hitting all this material coming inwards. And so you got this period where these two outward and inward forces are sort of unstably balancing each other. And it's the reheating by all these neutrinos passing through this matter and dumping some of their energy that revives the shockwave and makes the star explode. So it takes many months of CPU time on supercomputers to do these sort of simulations. I'll just show you the results of one of them here. This is from Thomas Janka's group at Garching in Germany. Now, how do I... Uh-oh. Anybody, you know, if I have a mouse, I click on this and it plays. Okay, so you can see the shockwave propagating outwards. And you could see the shockwave stalling now. And then as the neutrinos go streaming through this matter, it heats it up and you start to get more and more turbulence in this matter. So this is solving the Navier-Stokes equations that we heard about a couple of days ago, except it's in a general relativistic framework and you have to take into account all the neutrinos interacting with all the other elements. So it's a very complicated problem. And you see that you start to get these two-lobed oscillations in the matter in this neutron star. And as it gets heated up more and more, these oscillations become bigger and more violent. And then finally, it sort of fissions and it ruptures, and that's when the star explodes. And so the time scale there is, okay, 5 minutes. So we'll be able to see those modulations in neutrino detectors here on Earth. So I'll just skip that. This is supernova 1987A, which was the only occasion when we've observed neutrinos coming from a supernova. We observed a grand total of 23 of them in three neutrino detectors on Earth. Most of those, almost all of them, were electron-type antineutrinos. Now, each phase of a supernova will emit different species of neutrinos, as you can see here. And this is all theory. You know, we have almost no experimental data to check on these theoretical models. By measuring the energy of these neutrinos, we'll be able to infer what the temperature inside that supernova is, just that you can infer the temperature of a bar of heated iron by looking at the colors of the light coming off. And so, The particular thing that my collaborators and I are doing is we want to build a detector that's sensitive to the electron-type neutrinos. All those other detectors just are sensitive to anti-electron neutrinos. And we do that by using lead as the detection medium. So our detector consists of the one we have built in Snow Lab in Sudbury, consists of 79 tons of hollow lead blocks from a decommissioned cosmic ray station and $6 million worth of helium-3 filled neutron detectors that we inherited from that earlier experiment in Sudbury. We have a big block of lead. The neutrinos knock out neutrons from the lead nuclei in the mass of lead. Those neutrons are bounce around and eventually get captured by the helium-3 gas inside these Geiger counters that we have mounted in our block of lead. Here's one of them here. So this is working 2 kilometers underground. So you can imagine all this rock on top of you as we go down there. Here's our neutrino detector. So compared to those huge tanks of water, this is a small thing. We're part of this worldwide network of neutrino detectors called the Supernova Early Warning System. The neutrinos come out several hours before the optical radiation does. So this gives an early warning for when the next supernova is going to explode in our galaxy. And right now we're designing an upgrade, something which is going to be something like 12 times bigger. It will be located in the Gran Sasso lab in Italy. It's going to be a 4.5 by 4.5 by 5.5 meter volume of lead with instrumented with all these helium-3 filled Geiger counters. So A core collapse supernova occurs about once, every 30 to 50 years in our galaxy. And our galaxy is about 100,000 light years in diameter. So the neutrinos from hundreds of supernova are already on their way to the Earth. So we're just getting ready to greet them when they arrive. They will come. That's the end of my talk.
Thanks, Dan. We have some time for questions.
I appreciate the early warning part of your question. So the question I have, now that you've got an upgrade going, is there an effort in mind to coordinate your work, the neutrino detection, along with the gravitational wave, as well as the EM community?
Multi-messenger.
Yes, so a supernova will also make a signal in the gravitational wave detectors. Now, in gravitational waves, just from the nature of gravity, is that they need a quadrupole type oscillation in order to make gravitational waves. And so if you get a dipole type, two lobe sort of oscillation, it does not make gravitational waves. And so it looks at a different aspect of the matter distribution in a supernova. But yes, there is coordination between the neutrino community and the gravitational wave community to look for these things.
I'm just curious about the, what's the threshold for your detector for the lower threshold of energy?
It's about 11 MeV.
Okay.
In the neutral current, it's about 11 MeV. In the charged current, it's more like 15 MeV. So we're only going to be looking at the high energy tail of the spectral distribution of neutrinos.
Okay.
Just curious, in the supernova simulation that you showed the little video, the two lobes are asymmetrical. Is that a finite size effect of the computational model, or is there some physical reason why it's asymmetrical?
That just comes out of the simulation. It's a result of the reason why it goes into two lobes is just because there is a hydrodynamic instability problem.
One lobe looks different from the other.
Yeah, I think that's a projection effect. To conserve momentum, the amount of matter going in one direction must be equal to that coming out the other.
Any one last question? Okay, well, let's thank our speaker.
We talked about the improbability of these particles hitting our bodies, but they do. So is there an effect on our biology at all when we have that contact?
No. In fact, on the morning of February 10th, 1987, when supernova 1987A exploded, everybody on Earth was probably irradiated by like 10 to the power 13 neutrinos, and I'm sure nobody felt anything. In fact, every second of the day, something like a dozen cosmic ray muons go zipping through your body each second, as we're sitting right here. And that does not do any harm to you, and you can't feel it. And so one neutrino hitting something in your body, we just like one of those 10 per second, that's already going through your body.
Thank you.